On behalf of the Colorado Life Service Group, welcome. We're so excited to have you here and so excited to have Sherry here. And Jeff and I are co-chairs of the committee, but other committee members are here, and you can tell because we all have name tags. So again, welcome. And actually, this journey for us began 18 months ago when Jeff and I both read Sherry's book, and we both loved it. And we said, we've got to bring Sherry out to Colorado. So we wrote to her. I look back, it was December of 2013, almost 18 months ago. And so it took us a while to get here, but we're very, very excited to be here and to have her here. And I don't know how many of you read her book, but it's very, very impactful book. And actually, she's written two other books, The Feminine Face of God and The Cultural Creatives, which I haven't read. But I did actually read this book, A Ripening Time, again in the last 2 weeks, and I think it's actually something I'm going to read probably every year or two. I think it's that important of a book. And have any of you read her book that are here tonight? Okay. So if you have, you know that she is a beautiful writer, and there's an openness and a vulnerability and a humor that comes through, and the stories. You know, she's really a trailblazer in this field of aging. Most of us, we get into our 60s and we start to think about, oh my God, we're aging and what are we going to do? But she actually started in her 40s and started forming elder groups to talk about aging, talk about how they felt about it, and has done workshops all over the world. We've actually hoped that maybe in the future we'll actually have a weekend workshop with her coming back out to Colorado. So, but I think most of it, you get so many great stories from all the people she's talked through those 30 years and their experiences and their fears and their challenges, but also the amazing gifts and blessings that come with aging that we don't always think about and our culture doesn't really talk too much about. So I actually went back to her website, and it, when I was reading it again, it reminds me her words are how I felt when I read her book. So I'm going to read those words to you, and I invite you to go see her website. Starts with welcome. Please come in. Imagine that we're together, you and I, seated at the edge of a vineyard laden with fruit. If you accept this invitation, you'll be stepping into ripening time. Ripening meaning coming to our full flavor as human beings. So without further ado, please join me in giving Sherry a warm welcome.
Thank you so much, Betty. That was very moving to be reminded of our journey till I got here. And your own response to reading the book. So I've been wondering who you are, thinking about you. In my time of working with the question of what does it mean to grow old, to age, what I've found is nobody is an expert. Nobody knows much of the inside story. And each of us has such gifts to share that it's really a great pleasure and great intrigue and interest to really listen to the fruits of a full life. I thought I might start with a poem that you probably have heard many times, but it just speaks to the gifts that we bring as we age. It's from T.S. Eliot. He says, "As we grow older, the world becomes stranger, the pattern more complicated of dead and living. Not the intense moment isolated with no before or after, but a lifetime burning in every moment." And then he says toward the end, "Old people ought to be explorers." Don't you love that? Old people ought to be explorers. That's us. "Here and there does not matter. We must be still and still moving into another intensity for a further union, a deeper communion." So that notion, old people ought to be explorers, that, I think, is what makes this time so important, so exciting, so deeply worthy of our attention. So, you know, the name of my book is called Ripening Time. I came up with that name because when I decided that I was going to write this book about aging, every time I told people that I was writing a book about aging, they looked bored. And they would find an excuse to walk away. Or else they'd say, "Oh, how fascinating. Excuse me, I think I see something." And so I thought, I've got to find a name, a word that conveys something of the importance and richness. And aging doesn't seem to do it. So I kind of rooted around, and I found this old word that it comes from the Old English, like the 14th century origin of the word to reap. And from the word to reap, you get the word ripening, which means to come to full flavor. And you think about ripe cheese, ripe grapes that grow into wine. And so if you feel into what that might mean for your own life, to come to your full flavor as a human being, what is that? What does that mean? You know, when we think about what we admire in our culture, there's people who do these amazing feats, the great Olympians, or people who make a lot of money, or people who invent, you know, marvelous new discoveries and inventions. So it's always some extreme accomplishment that is admired in our culture. But if you think about what does it mean to fully be a human being, to come to our full flavor, our maturity as human beings. Isn't that like a fantastic question? A question worthy of our attention? And yet, it's almost never asked. The whole field of developmental psychology is only started at around 1980. So, you know, maybe 50 years old. And developmental psychology really meant children. And so the notion that maturity means into middle life and through the fullness of life, that's new. So we're living in a new time. I'll tell you a story. Several years ago, I stopped work. I stopped all the work I was doing, and I didn't do anything that year except I took a group of women on a river trip down the Colorado, and we did some ceremony around becoming elders. And when a year or two later, I was in a yoga class, and a young woman came up to me. She seemed young to me, anyway. And she said, "I need to talk to you. I'm turning 50, and I want a ceremony so I can become an elder." So, we talked, and I gave her a couple ideas for her birthday party, and we became friends. And over the next couple months, we would walk and talk, and she would say to me, "You need to write a book about growing old because I need it, and people like me need it. And come on, because you see, if people like me who are turning 50 aren't looking forward to what we can mature into, what's going to happen to all the ones behind me? She was a coach, all my coaching clients in their 30s and 40s who are looking up to me. If I'm trying to become younger next year, like the books say, I don't know where to go. So it's up to you. Settle down and write down something about growing old." So at that time, I was around 67. I'm 72 now. And I thought I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know what to do. And I forgot that in my 40s, I had already been wanting to know, what does it mean to be a human being? And I think if you want to know what it means to be a human being, you want to know about completeness. You want to know about what's maturity. How do you mature? And so where do you look? To 35-year-olds? To what you're like when you're 40? Or even 50? How do you find out what it means to be a human being? The full flavor of a human being. I think that's going to come from people like us. People who want to be conscious, who are willing to ask the deep questions, who are open to not knowing and becoming explorers. So you probably know the statistics. In the last century, we've had an evolutionary leap from longevity being something like 35 years around the world to being now 78 years in the West. So it's an evolutionary eye blink. And we all of a sudden have a generation and a half more of life than our grandparents had. So the time, the new time that we're in, is a longer time than we've ever had before. It's also a time for many of us, not for all of us, of course, where we're safe enough and educated enough and healthy enough that we can begin to sit with the deep questions and explore what happens as we age. We have the capacity to do that now. So think about it for a minute. Why Why does it matter? Why is it so important that we have another 35 years, another generation and a half of life? What does it matter in terms of consciousness, in terms of wisdom, in terms of a capacity for generosity, in terms of self-reflection? Human beings take such a long time to grow up. You know, I think I'll see if I can read you this. I probably say it better here. Think about how helpless we are as infants and children compared to other species. It takes us so long to be able to live without our parents' support. So very long to develop our intelligence and adaptability and skills, to grow in our compassion and wisdom, good judgment and discernment. To put it bluntly, it takes all of us a very long time to grow up, and most of us never do. So we have more time. Think what you were like 30 years ago, and where you abide now. What capacities of heart, perspective, kindness, intelligence, sympathy, etc., etc. Words, capacities that we don't even have names for because they're so subtle that we can maybe recognize them, but we don't have names for them yet. We're so new. We're a new, I don't know if we're a new fruit on the vine or we're a new variety or we've gone further, but what we can become now is has never been seen before on the face of the earth, because there's never been, you see, not only do we have so much more time, but there are so many more of us. In 20 years, one in four people will be over 65 on the planet. A quarter of the population are going to be elders. Now, will we have the wisdom of elders? Will we have the capacities of a deep, true elder? That's the interesting question. And what do we need to do? What's possible for us now? So, as I said, there are no experts. One woman who's the head of a big gerontology department at Stanford said, if you don't understand the landscape you're in now as you're aging, welcome to the club. There are no experts. We're finding our way. So I don't have a map for how to navigate the territory of aging, but I have a compass. And the compass that I have is questions. I've learned how to ask questions of myself and other people, and I've learned how to listen. So I think I'll tell you a story about elders and questions that Jeff reminded me of tonight. Once upon a time, about 100 years ago, in Middle Europe, there lived a woman named Rose. And Rose was a baker of bread, a wonderful baker of bread. But something odd happened to her the year that she turned I think it was 50, but it could have been 55 or 60 or who knows when. But some point, she began to wake up in the morning, and instead of singing a little song and being happy to wake early and bake her bread, she got a frown on her face. And she said, "I've had that dream again." And her husband said, "What dream?" And she said, "Well, I don't exactly remember it, but it's that question. There's a question that keeps coming up in my dream." And then she asked her husband if he knew the answer to the question, and he didn't know. So then she went and she asked her sisters and her friends, and they didn't know. And then she put on her best shawl and she baked a special challah for Shabbat, and she traveled across the river to the Rebbe, and she asked the Rebbe, "Here's my question. Every morning I wake up and I have this question. Do you know the answer, Rebbe?" And he said, "No, I'm sorry. I don't know the answer to your question, but I heard that there's a wise elder 7 days' journey from here. Why don't you go and ask the elder?" So that's what Rose decided to do, and she packed up. It was very courageous because she had to walk all by herself, and there were wolves and bears. She slept on the ground. Sometimes she could find a barn to sleep in. And after 7 days and seven nights, she finally arrived at this little village where the elder was supposed to be, and she went to the town square. She said, I'd like to meet with the elder." And they said, "Sorry, you can't speak to the elder. The elder is in retreat contemplating the mysteries of the universe. And you can come next year. The elder will be available then." And Rose said, "You don't understand. I've walked for 7 days and slept on the ground for seven nights to talk to the elder. I need to talk to the elder." And they said, "Too bad. The elder is not available." But Rose was smart. So she said, "Oh dear, I'm so sorry that's happened. Well, since I've traveled so far, could you just point out the house of the elder for me? Just so I can see it." They said, "Oh yeah, it's up the hill there around the gooseberry bushes. The elder's there. But you know, you can't see her. In fact, every day at noon, a boy comes and he leaves her food there. He knocks on the door and he leaves her food. And then when he leaves, she takes the food in, but she sees no one." So Rose said, "Thank you." And she walked up the hill when they weren't looking, and she hid in the gooseberry bushes. And after a while, the boy came and he knocked on the door and left the basket. Rose got ready, and the door opened, and Rose flung herself into the room. And the elder's looking at her, and she starts to talk very fast, and she goes, "Hello, you haven't met me before, but my name is Rose, and I've traveled all this way, 7 days, and I slept on the ground 7 nights, and I really need to talk to you because I have a question that won't go away, and it keeps waking me up." And then she told the question to the elder. And the elder listened, and she went, and she smacked Rose on the cheek, and Rose went, "You must not understand. I'll speak louder. I know that elders often have trouble hearing. I have a question that won't go away, and I've walked all this way to ask you my question." And she asks the question again. And the elder goes, and she smacks her on the other cheek, and she kicks her out the door, and she slams the door and locks it. And Rose is sitting in the dust, cursing, going, "Stupid elder." They think that's a wise elder. That's not a wise elder. That's a stupid elder. She doesn't know anything. She's brushing herself off. And she starts walking down the hill, and she's talking to herself, and she's in a rage. And a guy comes behind her, and he says, "Excuse me, can I help you? You seem to be upset." And Rose tells him the story, stupid elder. And he says, "You know, I think I know what happened. Come to my house for a schnapps, and we'll talk about it." So Rose comes to his house and have a schnapps. And he says, "I think the first time the elder slapped you was because you thought the questions had to have answers. And the second time the elder slapped you was that you were willing to trade your precious question for somebody else's answer." So when I first heard that story, I was embarrassed, very embarrassed, because I knew that that's what I had been doing most of my life, trying to trade my precious questions for somebody else's answers. Books, teachers. And I began to pay more attention to my own questions. So, and you know, a question doesn't have to be a question like a sentence with a question mark. It can be a longing or a line of a song that won't go away or something you see that you don't know how to make sense of. And instead of letting it just drop, or telling yourself you're stupid to keep turning toward it, you let it live in you. And I think as we begin to grow older, more and more deep questions arise in us, and they can teach us, they can show us the way if we let them. So, that sounds good, yeah? Oh yeah, my questions, that sounds pretty good. So I'd like to talk to you about what gets in the way of our asking our questions. Couple, one or two things, and then talk about probably the deepest kinds of questions that come to us as we age. So when I finally settled down to start to write this book and had my title, and I really loved waking up early in the morning and just sitting to see, you know, what would come. And it was really interesting for a couple of weeks. And then I got bored. It's like, and I started thinking, like, what is the matter with me? How come I'm interested in stuff about elders? And I could hear my inner advisor saying to me, "Why aren't you interested in something interesting like tango lessons, or take a course in something, or go to the gym more often, or, you know, why are you interested in elders?" And not only that, wasn't only my inner critic, but my friends were saying it as well. I had a friend, I call him Harry in the book, a very kind of glamorous guy. Very exotic guy, and he'd had a very interesting life. And I went for a walk with him one day, and in the marsh. And he, out of nowhere, he says, "Why are you interested in this aging thing?" So I looked up at him, and he said, "People like us are not interested in this aging thing." And I thought, what does he mean, people like us? Does he mean I'm like him, sort of exotic and fascinating? And he said, so I was like, yeah, people like us. So he said, yeah, you know, ever since I was a young man, I looked for moments of beauty. And I still look for moments of beauty. And my body, I am as healthy as I was in my 20s. And I'm still wear the same jackets. And, you know, I'm still slim and still slim. And he went on like this for a while. And I just kept thinking, what's he talking about, people like us? And I couldn't think of anything to say. And so he repeated, people like us don't need to be interested in this aging thing. And we walked on. So later, I thought of a lot of reasons why people like me could be interested in this aging thing. But at the time, I wanted to be exotic and fascinating like my friend. And I realized that one of the things that started to happen was that all the memories that I had of aging from my grandparents began to come back. And we have, you know, we have our memories from childhood. If you're 60 or older, your memories of what it means to get old that were formed when you were a child are probably from people who were born before 1900. What old means, you can say it's hidden away by the elves of childhood, and that sits right next to whatever Gloria Steinem looks like now, whatever Ruth Bader Ginsburg at 91 and the Supreme Court is able to do now. These impressions from very early are also there of what we think old means. And depending on our personal experience, we might have a beautiful memories of old. Our grandmother sitting with a rosary and somehow a silence around her that wasn't around anybody else. No matter, she didn't say anything, it didn't matter. Or our grandfather who got old somehow all of a sudden and could no longer lift us up and take us for walks. It's personal, intimate memories that we maybe never look at. But they're there, along with our impression of what's happened to our own parents, and now our friends, and now ourselves. So the whole idea of what old means gets hidden away, and we don't unearth it, we don't examine it. So one way to understand what that is to say that our impression from our culture, from our own memories, from the literature, about what does it mean to grow old, is a whole mess of stuff that's pretty much unexamined. So, I have a question for you, and we can let the mic go around. I'm going to ask you, I'm going to ask you the question, and just raise your hand if you can, if you're willing to plunge in. Okay. Tell me a lie about growing old.
Wrinkles are ugly.
Wrinkles are ugly. Thank you. Tell me a lie about growing old.
Oh, thank you. it's boring.
Thank you. Tell me a lie about growing old.
I thought we were volunteering. Okay.
That's a good answer. Well,
thank you.
Lie about growing old. It's uninteresting.
Thank you.
Because I find it rather interesting.
Okay, anybody else? Tell me a lie about growing old, Stephanie.
It's all about loss.
It's all about loss. Thank you. Tell me a lie about growing old, Earl.
It is about loss.
Tell me a lie about growing old, Susan.
You get sick and then you die.
You get sick and then you die. Your children and your grandchildren will want to spend every moment of their special time with you, and it will be a beautiful period. Jeff, tell me a lie about growing old.
I've been preparing this. I have no questions about it.
That's a lie.
You lose your memory.
That's not a lie.
Thank you.
Younger people will want to hear your opinions about things.
Yes, thank you. Yes, you'll have so much wisdom that younger people will gather around you. Eileen, tell me a lie about growing old.
It's all downhill from here.
Thank you. Want to try? Okay.
I won't have any value as I get older.
Thank you. So, breaking open the lies, the assumptions, the stinky stuff under the rug, the stuff we haven't looked at. And you know, it's funny, this question about tell me a lie, because you begin to realize, I don't know what's true. Is it true it's all downhill from here? Or it's all uphill from here? Or it's a fucking roller coaster? You know, what's true? But that's where you start, right? You start with, I don't know what's true. And I'm interested. So that's where letting questions be your North Star, your compass, your modality, gets beyond the received wisdom, the statistics, what your grandmother looked like, what your father thought about your grandmother, what your aunties said about the, etc. All of that, you start to open it up. It starts to open. And as I said, the questions aren't you know, necessarily formed questions, but their curiosity, their wonder, their wanting to know. So once I began to be interested in the lies about growing old and the cultural beliefs about growing old, I could see where the boredom was coming from, and it started to break open. I started to get really interested. So here's a, let's see if I can remember this poem. 10,000 flowers in summer, the moon in autumn. Oh, I think I'm going to, I won't do that to you. Let me see if I can actually do the poem. Here we go. 10,000 flowers in springtime, the moon in autumn, a cool breeze in summer, snow in winter. When your mind is not clouded by unnecessary things, every season is the best season. Every season is the best season. I did a teleconference a couple weeks ago with a group of people I'd been working with for some time, and the topic that they wanted to look at was choices for the end of life. And the person who kicked this off was a lawyer, and she had read an article that maybe some of you have read by a famous ethics professor from Yale, who's also an oncology professor, named Zeke Emanuel. He's Rahm Emanuel's brother. And he wrote an article in The Atlantic called "I Want to Die at 75. Yeah, so some of you read it. And this woman had read it, and she was very interested. So all the people on the teleconference read the article, plus a whole bunch of other things. And I read it too. And his basic argument is, after, I forget, say 70, he's not going to do anything, take any medical procedures that will prolong his life. No flu shots, no prostate cancer examinations, no none of the normal things you'd be doing at 70. He'll take an aspirin if he has a headache or something like that, but palliative measures are okay, but nothing that could prolong his life. Why? Because, he says, he's seen his father, who is an eminent surgeon, and how his father has slowed down, and how his father seems now to settle for a slower life. He doesn't publish anymore. He's not vigorous the way he used to be. And he just, in Zeke Emanuel's opinion, his father has kind of given up. And when he asks his father, "Why have you done this?" his father says, "I'm actually very fulfilled and happy." But Zeke doesn't believe him. Mm-hmm. So and then he goes on to say, the things that are so important to him, his creativity, he publishes a book a year, his wonderful vigor, he climbs mountains with his nephews, his sense of humor, his vitality, his strength, the zest he feels for life, how quick his mind is, all of that will go. He sees that. And he doesn't want to be alive for it. So I started to get mad. And I thought, who is this guy? So I Googled him, and I thought, how old is he? How old do you think he was? 40, 55. Yeah, he's like late 40s, early 50s. He's writing this. It's a young man's or a middle-aged man's perspective, which is fine. His season of life, that's fine. But he doesn't seem to understand that his values might change, not because he's giving up, but because there's something to learn. There's actual development that can happen, and it hasn't occurred to him that way. And as I was getting mad about that, I realized that I would have agreed with him completely when I was, you know, 45 or something. And I remember, I don't know if you know this guy, he's a writer, Michael Mead. He's written a lot of men's books, and he's a wonderful storyteller. And I heard Michael speak at a conference when I was in my 40s. And I was so moved by what he said. And he said, I want to learn how to let the hero die so the elder can be born. And I was like, right on, Michael, yeah. But I realized later, that's a kind of heroic perspective, that it's up to Michael to let the hero die so Michael can let the elder be born. And it doesn't exactly work that way. So I want to move to, so there's a lot to be explored and some really interesting things to see about the process of asking questions as we age. But I'd like to move to the hardest questions. Let me see. I guess I'll have to go here. Oh, yeah, let me read you this quote first. This is from Carl Jung. We cannot live the afternoon of life according to the program of life's morning. For what was great in the morning will be little at evening. And what in the morning was true will at evening have become a lie. And what in the morning was true will at evening have become a lie. So, it's another way of saying that the truth that's ours to live is what we need to live. And if we hold on to what was the truth in our 40s or 50s or 20s, then what we'll be living in our 60s and 70s and 80s will no longer be the truth. It'll be some illusion. It'll be some fixity. It'll be some cardboard fake thing that we're trying to squeeze ourselves into. So, what is it that lets us engage the really deep questions, the hard stuff of our lives? A woman that I interviewed many years ago named Mary Morrison, she was a gospel studies teacher at Pendle Hill in Pennsylvania. She said, there is one heroic question. So she too was looking for the heroic question that if you let yourself ask it, will take you into the really deep living of a human life. And her form of the question was, how do you face the inevitable diminishment that is going to come to you as you age? Yeah, thank you. Just feel how that lands on you. How do you face the inevitable diminishment that is going to affect you as you age? My friend David and I were working with a group of elders in Berkeley, and I brought this question to them, and everybody groaned. They were like, "Oh!" And so I had them work with a question in groups of three to explore how do you face the inevitable diminishment that is coming as you age. And they got into it. They really got into it. And they, because it was forbidden, and so they got into it. And so then it had all this juice and aliveness, and people started standing up and sharing and saying, if I can't face these questions, I can't become mature. It's not going to happen. And we need to be able to do it together. And so it was very exciting. And we went on with some questions like that. And then something started to happen. And I noticed that I was getting sleepy, like embarrassingly sleepy, like groggy sleepy. And it felt like this sort of greasy gray fog was coming in through the windows, and everybody was sort of like this. And David, my co-teacher, leans over and he says to me, denial. And we go, oh yeah, right. So we may have a break for lunch. We come back from lunch and we give people a question to work with. And the question is something like, tell me a way you deny your experience of diminishment. Everybody groans. But they start to work with the question. And then the second question was something like, what's right about denying your experience of diminishment? And you could feel that greasy gray fog of the denial start to open up. And it was so clear that we can't do this alone. We can't do the difficult questions alone. It's too hard. I was talking with some people before we started tonight, and I was telling them that when I first started working with groups of very senior students in the school, I asked them whether they were inquiring into their experience of aging, and nobody was. And I'm beginning to understand why. Because it's too hard. We need each other. We need to be able to ask these questions, share our experiences. Some kind of structure is good to help to, you know, to ask the difficult questions. But I think it's too hard to do alone. I don't think people do it alone. We just go back into denial. And then we get bored or sleepy and wonder why we ever turned to this topic in the first place and what's good on television right now. Right? So I'd like to read you a little quote from wonderful Jungian Helen Luke, who wrote this when she was 83. "For those who embrace the gifts reserved for age, old age becomes freedom, becomes the dance." And it actually, there's a longer piece. I'll see if I have it here. Yeah. So, what are the gifts reserved for age? The hard stuff. Losses, endings, a sense of disorder where there was order, the things that you don't want to face and you turn away from, and most of all, and in a way most interesting of all, is the way that what the capacities that we thought were ours, that belong to us, begin to leave us. Jeff and I were talking about our days of running or skiing downhill or climbing. Our beauty, what we took to be our beauty, our how quick we are, how good our memory is, how many friends we have, how reliable we are, how outgoing and friendly we are. Is everybody's giggling? Yeah. It's like, you know, all these things that you think are you begin to change or fade or disappear. And it's not you. And not only that, my husband, my friend, one of my, the people in my group were talking about losses, and she said, "My husband has Alzheimer's. I've lost my friend. He still lives in the house, but I've lost my friend." Losing, 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 losing. And so it's not just losing stuff. In fact, you might have more stuff and more stuff and more stuff, but it's losing what you thought you were. So in a way, you could say it's spirituality in the fast lane, because like you were saying, I thought we were supposed to volunteer for this. I love that. But it's like, yeah, I didn't volunteer for this. I didn't volunteer for this, and it's happening anyway. And so in a way, that's one of the most fascinating things about aging, because you don't have to sign up for Ridwan or Buddhism or, you know, whatever spiritual path involves all kinds of work and effort. And it's like, if you're old, it's going to happen anyway. And the question is, can it happen consciously? Yes. And I think that's happening to our entire world now. Our entire civilization has an opportunity now to become conscious, because we're losing the who we thought we were. One in four of us. You can't believe the old stories anymore about getting and spending and how that's going to mean so much and being successful. So how long does that last for? And but then, those who embrace the gifts reserved for age, for them, old age becomes freedom, becomes the dance itself. So, in traditional societies, you know, there were profound initiation rites for young boys And for young girls, they were different, but there were initiation rites. And also for like medicine men and healers. And you were always taken away. And everything that you thought belonged to you was taken away. And you went into your death. You went into the place of death. And what you learned there was what allowed you to have a deep and true life from then on. And they're very profound. If you read about the initiation rites or if you've ever done Vision Quest kinds of things. Well, old age makes initiates of us all. We are living that initiation. So we might as well be awake. And I think we might as well help each other and listen to each other. I wanted to tell you, at one point, a group I was doing, we were inquiring into issues around aging, and it was going pretty well. And there was a man I was really curious about. He was a really big guy, and he was Dutch, and he had a sort of wild beard and wild hair. And he would walk from the bus station, which was quite a ways to get to our meeting. Everybody else drove. He didn't have a car. And I asked him where he lived, and he lived like an hour away by bus. So we started to ask him how come he came to this meeting, which everybody else drove like 10 minutes to get to. And he said, I tried to start a men's group where we could talk about issues of aging. And at first it was really successful. Everybody wanted to tell their stories about, you know, their younger life and some of their issues. But when we started getting to the hard stuff, they dropped like flies. And he said, I did this three separate times and didn't work. And he said, I think there's something about having men and women together that's really important. And there's something about having a structure that supports us to ask our deep questions. That seems like we need that kind of support now. So I think I'll read you just some lines from the end of the book, and then I'd like to open the space for anything you want to share. The urgency of our time and the unprecedented billions of elders on the planet make a fertile field for a fundamental mind change about our future now. Everyone who wants to be included is needed. To do whatever you can do, expose a lie about growing old, delve into the mysteries and subtleties of aging, reap the generosity and kindness and wisdom that come from being present through losses and endings. And in any and all ways you can find, deepen your humanity through the breadth and length of your years. Maturity is not what you look like or what you act like. It's not how photogenic you are with your white hair and wrinkles, or how many stories you may or may not be able to tell. And I think it's not even an openness of mind, a perspective that takes in the long-term view, though that is a great gift. Maturity, it seems to me, is what has been gestating and growing in you all these years, a wholehearted humanness. And I believe it's a willingness to stand by, to stand for what you love. The point is not to know a map for getting old, but to be the map and to be willing to ask the questions. So let's sit for a few minutes. Just sit. And then we'll open the space for sharing and comments and questions. Sorry, that was louder than I thought. So the space is open. Jeff can pass around the mic.
I was quite intrigued when you said about our particular addiction to great achievement. And I see how often I get hooked into that, and in the past couple of years I have let go of a particular career that I had thought I would have gained a great achievement. So when I turned 50 and the great achievement hadn't been reached, I notice that I've been grieving that.
Yes, good to notice that and to honor the grieving, huh?
It's not easy.
No. What have you learned?
I have learned to let go.
Yeah.
And breathe.
Yeah. Thank you. Did you have your hand up? No.
Well, this is the best time of my life.
I think...
Aim it at you.
Oh, yeah.
This is the best time of my life. I like that I've grown older. I was always very immature. So I feel more mature now. And it's nice. You know, I was frivolous.
What do you like about this time of your life?
Oh, there's less to do. I have more time to myself. I had missed that a lot because I was always busy taking care of other things, responsibilities and stuff. And so now I have more time to myself and doing things that I like. And I understand more about life, which I didn't before. And I'm aware of that, that there's... And also it's easier for me to accept things, which was not so easy when I was younger.
That's interesting to notice that, huh?
I was on my high horse, you know. And now it's, So I like it. The only thing I don't like about it is the diminishing part.
Yeah, so you can feel how, you know, you would like to pick and choose. Like, I like this part, and I don't like that part. But they're all here.
Yeah.
And so are we, if we let ourselves be. Yeah. And then what does that allow? What does that allow if we don't split apart the stuff we like from the stuff we don't like about growing old? We go, it's all here. How is that for me?
Yeah.
And then who knows what can happen?
Yeah. We just have to do less. That's okay.
Okay. Thank you.
I want to say a huge thank you. My book, like that, probably has 1,000 sticky notes in it. It's become a guidebook for me in the work that I do with women. In working with those very deep soul level questions, and very much somebody, you, articulated the journey that I had been on for about 8 years of this very deep self-examination and waking up piece into what it is to age consciously. And I think that process of waking up is so fundamental and key. And my reflection in the reverse from that is watching my father at 91, who has spent his whole life figuring out how not to get old, very healthy until quite recently. But then gradually having everything fall away that he perceived made him him. So his memory, his place of the inventor and making things with his hands, driving. So then I ask, if everything that we think we are as we get older, if we are so bent on being 80 and 90 and healthy, but at some point things fall away, and then who are we? What makes us who? Not articulating this quite well. Who are we then, I guess? And what if what we perceive that makes us us, which in my father's case is mostly external, which makes me come back to this place of, okay, what's the inner place of spiritual maturity and evolution? Is that who I am? And I don't have any answers. To me, it is the questions. I sit with these questions. I play with these. To me, it is a fascinating journey. And I have loved except for the aches and the pains. I have loved this place of self-inquiry. It has become a real rich mine of gold and silver and diamonds and rubies for me. And I was always frustrated that you were going to Amsterdam and going to Alaska and all over the place. It's like, will she come here, please? And so I just got an email tonight from my friend Malia, who turned me onto your book, said, you need to read this. And so I dropped everything and came here. So
that's great.
But it's the question I'm left with, and don't expect an answer, of just what is it makes us who we are? What is that place if we are so bent on living for a long time and healthy for a long time? At some point, the diminishment, I think, happens. And then who are we? And so those are just some of my own, because he's in this half full or half empty place with the cup, you know, and all he can see is his losses.
Yes.
And yet he's manifested pretty much everything in his life that he put his mind to. And he's in this place where he can't see that. It's like, okay, what are my lessons around watching that?
Yeah. And how it affects you. To see this and your questions, you feel how wonderful it is to have these questions that are really intimately real. They're your questions. Who are you when all that falls away? And whatever ideas you had about who that would be are just ideas. What's real? And then sitting with your father and maybe the power of grieving for his suffering will just keep opening the not knowing.
Right.
Yeah, thank you very much. That's nice to meet you.
Thank you.
I just thought of a poem by Hannah Block. She wrote this about Mark Rothko, who, you know, the great artist. And Rothko apparently went to the Grand Canyon when he was old, but he went at night, and he kept going at night because he wanted to paint the Grand Canyon at night, when it was completely dark. And she wrote this poem for him, and that the poem says at the end, "Pilgrim, bring back something from the edge of nothing to help us see." And I feel like we're pilgrims. And life brings that to us, to travel to the edge of nothing. And what's there? Yeah, thank you. Betty?
So I'm curious, when you say that we need to do it together, that we need support, because then I'm in a world of working with older people, so I see more isolation pulling in. I see it in myself as I'm aging. And more, you know, almost like a survival thing about pulling in and taking care of yourself, not being so involved in what's happening in the world. And so I'm kind of curious what you've seen in your groups. Where does the support come from? Where does the coming together come from when this other force seems to be happening?
Well, you know, it is true that one of the things, I'm sure you know, that people notice as we age, we get much more discriminating about how we spend our time. And things that we used to maybe go, oh, yeah, party, great. Oh, that sounds like fun with a bunch of people. I don't know. I used to be like that. Oh, yeah, party. Now it's like, are we going to have people over for dinner? Two people, yes. Not more. And so we get more discriminating, and we want to spend our time on whatever it is that has meaning for us, and we call our friends so that the people that we spend time with are people that mean something to us, that we care about. So there is that. But the question of how can we... discover the and support the inner wisdom and capacities that develop with aging, and how do we be with what wakes us up at night and the fears that we don't even have words for? How do we create something like that? In the back of my book, I have questions that can be used for a group if people want to create a support group. But that's not really necessary. That's just one kind of form. You can call a friend, and your friend can call two friends, and four people are enough if you want. And you can read one of the many marvelous books that are out there now that interest you about aging or dying or consciousness related to aging, and use that to kick off your discussion and make something, create and go to a movie together, like Still Alice is one, and there's a lot of movies out there. And, you know, find the form that works for you, and it doesn't have to be forever. You know, you could say, let's try it for 3 months. And would you have any suggestions? What's your name?
Carrie.
Here, why don't you take the mic? Because you said you worked with groups of women. Yeah.
So I sent an email out to about 15 women to see who would respond. And about 9 did, and that's kind of coming down to about 7 who are actually willing to make a commitment to come once a month. And we have, everybody brings some food because we all like to eat and have a glass of wine. So that's our sort of nourishment piece, because I feel like nourishing ourselves is very, very important. So we have something to eat and sit in a circle. And there's just a check-in at first. And then there's usually a question that I've posed or the group has come up with, and I've emailed it to everybody. And we spend the last hour and a half sharing our insights, our thoughts. Like this next month, we're dealing with the sense of a concept of loss. And that could be loss on any number of levels. We've dealt with death. One woman had just lost her husband extremely suddenly. We've dealt with devotion. We've dealt with all sorts of different things. There's all sorts of range of questions. And then we bring it to a close and figure out what we want to do the next month. And not everybody, sometimes I land something, or sometimes there's somebody's got something really burning that they want to talk about. But yeah. I ask people to make a commitment, for at least for us, because people go really deep, and there's a safety and a trust factor there, I found, at least for this group. And a lot of support, like we're there to really support each other in our tears and our fears and all of that.
Thank you. Thank you, Carrie. There's a group of women teachers in California, Ridwan teachers. We just started a group for the ones who are over. Oh, sorry, it's not women. It's all the teachers, but they're mostly women, over 70. And there's about 10 of us. And we do something different every time, because we don't know what to do. So we just, you know, see what we feel like doing. But so it's, you know, it's the Wild West. It's new. Nobody has, like, answers. And you don't have to be terribly brave, just a little brave, to call a friend and see, okay, me and my friend and maybe two more friends or something. And what would we like to do? One time I found a great poem that Charlie Chaplin wrote at his 70th birthday, and we read the poem, and then everybody wrote their own poems about what it was like to be the age they were. I mean, you could do anything and just keep letting it unfold. Yeah. So thanks for your question. Anybody else? We have let's take another 5 minutes or so and just sort of see if there's any more. Either it doesn't have to be a question, comment, where you are, how do you feel affected by this evening? Anything you feel like you'd like to give your voice to?
I don't know, this is probably going to expose me more than I want to feel comfortable being exposed, but I work with fairly young people, and what I'm experiencing is because this time in life doesn't have a lot of need for success and, you know, and I'm loving that so much that when I see that striving, you know, to be something and all that kind of work and all the efforting, it really affects me more. I don't know how to say it. I feel a great sadness about it, and it's hard to want to be with it. Because it's just so, it was such a painful part of not being, of being, you know, in those aspiring years.
Oh, are you
years.
Saying, like, the people that you work with, you yeah, see it in them, and
in
you
them,
find it hard to be with
yeah,
them?
Yeah, I just feel find it so hard to be with that.
That sounds like a really beautiful question to yeah. inquire into.
Thank you.
To see, because, you know, for everything there's a season.
Yeah, I know.
And so it sounds like there's probably something very rich there for you to see what's so hard for me about that. And just see, find out. Maybe there's some grieving that hasn't been done, or I don't know, but really, it can be very fertile.
Thanks.
You knew I'd say that. Right. Anybody else want to put their voice into the field here? You?
Mm-hmm. I think a lot about aging, and I think the question that comes up for me is, how am I going to be? So when I can't run anymore or do the things that I think are me, and it's like, how do you then be with that? How do you age gracefully in a way which is a lot of letting go? And how do you then find the next thing, you know? And so the thing that I think about is, how do I sort of want to travel this part of my life as I'm moving towards this other part in a way that allows me to be grateful and move to the next thing that includes the
So it sounds so, like you're already starting to contemplate this.
Yes.
You could ask, what is it in me that's curious about this? And kind of communing with
right.
the one that's wondering about this and asking about
because
it.
Because it does feel like it has its own potential.
Yeah.
Which is very different than, you know, like you were saying, everything has its season. So it's a different season and it has its own potential. And I sort of have this feeling like I don't want to miss whatever that potential is, you know.
So. That's a great attitude. Yeah, savor every moment.
I was just reminded that I read somewhere some poll that was taken that discovered that one of the happiest decades was the 80s.
Yeah, that's right.
People are, you know, kind of, they've made their peace with things. I'm coming up on it. And I'm part of me has a lot of fear about not being healthy, about the diminishment. But also on some level, it feels like if you don't get taken out early by something, it's an opportunity to sort of experience the full the full range of being human, and old age and the loss and the diminishment is all a part of understanding that full range somehow, that you're not going to understand it if you don't experience it.
Yeah, and then the question is, you know, what does understanding actually mean? And what does diminishment actually mean? So there is, you know, like objective diminishment of money, capacity, strength, and so on. But what else happens? And what happens if you're present to the diminishment and the sorrow of that, or the grief of that, or the loss of that? And then what's there? So it's like it keeps opening up.
Even the word diminishment is almost like a judgment.
I know.
To question, it is.
That's right. That's right. The researcher talking about, they call it the inverted U shape of happiness. And they started doing this research in, because the expectation was that when you're young, you're happy, and then it's all downhill. Who said, Eileen, it's all downhill? Or maybe when you're young, okay, when you're a teenager, you're a little screwed up, but, you know, and then you're kind of happy, and then maybe you're a little happier, and then it's all downhill. But when they rated happiness in all these different ways, they found out that teenagers were about the most unhappy, and that the happiness actually decreases. So teenagers are down here. Decreases, and when you're raising your kids and you're trying to make a living, and it's a very hard, and you're fighting with your spouse, and you're trying to find your way, that there's a lot of conflict there. It's hard times. And then as people, not quite their 80s, because their 80s are difficult physically, so there's issues around the 80s, but by the time you start to get 50s, 60s, 70s, the happiness goes up and up. And one of the things was like what you said, I'm not so judgmental anymore. I enjoy what I'm doing. I'm somehow, whatever it was that used to bother me about my partner or my spouse, that's not such a big deal anymore. We don't fight the way we used to. We actually kind of appreciate being together. And they've done all kinds of very interesting studies about emotion and how emotions are felt, and the longer time perspective that elders have. And so that those studies of happiness are very surprising to people. But as long as one thing that's very hard is when there's not enough money, and people have to work and they're really tired. So there are hard things about that. But part of that, a significant part of that, is the failure of our social safety net. And I...
So that points to the piece that I feel sad about. Like, I feel like I see a lot of the beauty and freedom of aging, and I've felt it in myself. And where I feel the sadness and the is that society doesn't see it, doesn't value it. And, you know, like I read an article recently about the dot-comers, you know, in their 40s, and the founders of eBay and Facebook, and it seems like across the board, they have billions of dollars, and they're investing it all in research on longevity. They all want to live to be 150 and beyond. And the last quote was from, I think, the founder of eBay, and he said, "I've always suspected that death is this awful thing, and it drives me crazy when people seem to move towards acceptance of it." And he said, "I'm going to fight it." And that just, there's something that seems so sad to me about that. You know, that there's people in their 40s that's what, you know, it seems like it's the height of power, the height of achievement, of financial success. And that without the wisdom of the elders, like, huge mistakes can be made.
And are being made.
And are being
made. And will continue
made.
To be made. Yeah, and that's interesting what you're saying. Okay, everybody. Thank you. Thank you. Oh, here I have one little piece I thought I'd read you. I enjoyed very much. The Alvin Ailey, the great dance company, had a program 2 years ago, and they called back some of their great dancers who were now in their 50s and 60s and asked them to perform in a program with the regular dancers. And it was a huge thing. And so these were like the prima ballerinas were invited back. Here, one former superstar and current artificial hip owner came out of retirement to dance at the special performance on New Year's Eve. And so a lot of them went on diets and they tried to get into shape. And one woman said she couldn't see why she would want to do this. She hadn't done anything in like 10, 15 years. But then her son said, "We've never seen you dance, Mom. We would love to see you dance." So some of these great dancers came back, and one woman said she wore gym clothes and socks because she didn't want to be seen in a leotard. And so you sort of get the picture. They interviewed some of the younger dancers who were partnering with the older dancers. And I wanted to read you a little piece of this just as a conclusion. At the rehearsal the other day, one of these great prima ballerinas, who was 55, danced with her partner, who was 31. And it said the dance was intimate and grueling, requiring the woman to push her body to extremes and put absolute trust in her partner. Afterwards, she said she felt an immediate connection. The dance just kind of flowed, she said, but she worried that her partner would feel he was dancing with his grandma. "Not at all," he said in a telephone interview. "I felt like I needed to be delicate, but not because I thought she was old, but because she's a jewel. I didn't want to do anything or say anything that would make it be a bad experience for her." He said that before dancing with this particular dancer, he'd never danced the piece before with a partner who had looked him directly in the eye. "It wasn't flirtatious," he said. "It felt a bit," he paused, "it felt a bit wild. And it opened up a new dimension of the work to me that I want to explore. I was a little taken aback." So will you join me, and let's bring our voices together to do an om to end. Om.
I have one very practical thing. So we recorded tonight, and if anybody is uncomfortable about having been recorded, would you come and see me? Because otherwise I'm going to put the whole thing up on our website for access for not only you folks, but whoever else might be interested. If I hear some objections to that, I will simply edit. So, thank you. And Betty, do you want to say something?
Some people haven't had the book signed.
Yeah, yeah. So Sherry's going to hang out here and talk and sign. And I just wanted to say thank you very much. Yeah. Beautiful. Yeah. If you survive this weekend, I hope we get you back sometime.